Thank you, David. So I want to start with questions from the audience. And the first one is for Dan. Why do presidents want to have their war? Just stay there.
Well, the reasons do differ. The situations are significantly different, I think, between Vietnam, for example, and Iraq. All kinds of differences. What I was pointing to was that in the two situations, as in all the situations between Democrat and Republican, we as Democratic citizens cannot afford the naivete and the ignorance that is involved in assuming that we can learn the reasons why they are going to war or carrying on a war from what they say. That is simply not an adequate understanding. By the way, one new thing in this situation is the possibility of learning a good deal more these days on the internet than what you would get from the handouts that are given to the major newspapers. I find, for example, www.antiwar.com, a very good source of editorials and comment from all over the world, really. Another one, commondreams.org. I just want to recommend these to you as ways of getting it. We're still asking, really, why Johnson went into Vietnam. Actually, that has perplexed me for a very long time. I do have some answers to it. I'll come to in a minute. What about, you said presidents, what about Iraq right now? Well, there's a number of reasons, I think. First, oil. Second, oil. Third, oil. And fourth, election. Fifth, support for Sharon's policy and the Christian right in this country, the evangelicals and whatnot, support for Sharon's sort of apocalyptic policies of Greater Israel at the moment. They are a big fact on Iraq. But coming back to oil, and this comes back to Johnson as well and all the people in between, there is a question of the president's feeling of obligation and responsibility and terrible pressure and anguish at running the world. And now that we are the single superpower in the world, this has definitely gone to the heads of a number of people, like Cheney, Rumsfeld, and others, oil men, who tend to see that the way to run the world is to control the oil reserves of the whole world, essentially. All the Middle East, not just Iraq. Iraq is a first step, and that's why we have here, it will not begin and end with Iraq, but pressure on regime change in Iran in various ways, in Saudi Arabia, which has been getting uppity and out of hand and in fact an actual danger to some degree in its actual support for Al-Qaeda. So in short, I would say when I look at Bush, and I have a little trouble getting inside the mind of Bush, actually, the way Bart was raising here, but Cheney and Rumsfeld, I don't know them any better either, but I do differ from Bart in one respect. When they say, I could quote it here, that their object is democracy in Iraq, and that as a model and a domino effect that will lead as a beacon of hope and cause democracy throughout the Middle East. When I read that in Newsweek recently, I wrote in the margin, I noticed, can Cheney really believe this, what he's saying? And Bart was saying, well, at least for Bush, he thought he could. Well, now, there is an Ellsberg principle that I learned in the Pentagon that could support that, which is, for Cheney and Rumsfeld, anyone can believe, can be as dumb as he has to be to keep his job. And intelligence is no obstacle here, and Cheney is very smart. I don't really think they do believe that. I don't know about Bush, where he is, but what he can believe. But Cheney can't believe that. I don't think there's a chance in the world that we would allow any more democracy in the next decade in Iraq than we supported or allowed in Iraq in the past when we were supporting Saddam or when we left him in power, for the reason that democracy would lead to a split up in Vietnam, or possibly, worst of all, the 64% of Iraqi citizens who are Shiites, as in Iran, might possibly elect a Shiite president. That was absolutely not going to be allowed to happen, who might combine with Iran. So in that case, they're just lying. Coming back to LBJ, frankly, as I say, I've been working at this for a long time. I'll give you an answer which I think does to some degree apply more, not to the administration as much, but to a lot of senators in Congress right now. After the major election of 64, your boss, from which you're Hubert Humphrey, told LBJ, from the perspective of Humphrey, the vice president then, who could count votes and who cared as much about the Democratic Party as Lyndon Johnson, as much of a cold warrior as Lyndon Johnson, told him, this is the time to cut losses. We were talking, and he said it was just before you worked for him. And that, in fact, was an enormous secret. As you were telling me, you didn't see that memo, although you heard about it. I didn't see it from the vice president working for McNaughton. I'm sure my boss didn't see it. A secret so great that it was not in the top secret Pentagon papers that I released. And it's only come out relatively recently. The biggest, longest kept secret of the Vietnam War was that cold warriors who had the ear of the president, who could not be dismissed, were telling the president constantly, this is a catastrophe. That's the word used by Clark Clifford and other counsel who practically invented the Cold War, working for Harry Truman, by Hubert Humphrey, who wanted to ban the Communist Party, by the way. And Humphrey and others saying, domestically, politically, this will be a catastrophe for you, as of course it was. It wasn't so hard to see. That raises the question, how could he have gone ahead against this? My guess is it wasn't domestic politics. If he'd stayed out, he would have been reelected in 1968. No president has ever lost an election for not getting us into a war, to my knowledge. A lot of presidents have run for election on the grounds that they kept us out of a war and then proceeded to get us in. Democrats in particular, one could say. But he would have been reelected. I don't think he was counting votes entirely. He had been in office when the in the Senate, when the Democrats were accused of losing China. We've paid a price, the world has paid a price, and this country has paid a price from Democratic congressmen and Democratic presidents for over 50 years for the fact, the accidental fact, that by an unforeseen victory of Harry Truman in 48, Democrats were in office when the communists won their civil war in China. And they were open to the accusation of having lost China. And for 50 years up till this day, and I believe that Lyndon Johnson, I don't say believe, but my best suspicion is that Lyndon Johnson in that case did not want to be accused of losing Vietnam, of being weak, weak on communism, being weak on militarism, not being sufficiently militaristic. And as he put it to Doris Kearns, being accused of being unmanly, an unmanly man. I think he was prepared to take the chance, which was a very high chance, which took place, of getting into a war which would destroy his presidency and make it impossible for him to run again, as Korea made it impossible for Truman to run again, even if he'd wanted to. In short, here's something we can all play a role, I think, to change. Many Americans have died, and 10 times as many foreigners have died in the last 50 years because of Democrats who were afraid of being called unmanly, weak on communism, weak on terrorism, weak on Osama bin Laden, weak on this, this, and that. And therefore, they got us into a war they knew was wrong. That is something that every mother, every father, every person in this audience can work to change that political environment so that we change the concept of manliness for our politicians and of their responsibility to us.
A question for Bart Bernstein. What kind of secrecy constraints do historians face in gaining access to records of recent American foreign policy? And actually, we've had a number of questions that are asking about why are we not getting access to documents from recent presidencies?
Technically, the Freedom of Information Act allows one to apply, and applying is a little like going into a dark area without illumination, having a shotgun that probably doesn't fire, and trying to hit a unicorn. That is, basically, the government at various levels has the power to say no, and it has various recondite ways of doing it. You can then appeal, and it has various recondite ways of saying no. Sometimes you succeed, very often you don't. Under a recent executive order by George Bush, there's a new restraint on presidential papers. Basically, the requirement is that president or his heirs and others involved have to give approval. Otherwise, on foreign policy in particular, as well as other matters, those papers in theory can remain closed in perpetuity on the grounds that the controlling interest is not citizens, the government, accountability, history, or even the erosion of time, but ownership. Ownership by people who in the beginning don't own, but are hired, who come to own through an executive order.
We're running a little bit longer than we'd hoped, so I'm gonna have to end with two last questions. For Daniel, why are there no more whistleblowers now? Why are there no more whistleblowers now in the Pentagon, State Department, Livermore Labs, etc.?
Well, that's not true, actually, the notion that there are none now, I'm glad to say. I infer that Bush is facing a military this time, in the opposite of Lyndon Johnson's situation, that does not want to go into this war. They don't want, I can only conjecture what their problems are in particular. I'll just give one. I don't think generals want to send their troops in to test their chemical warfare equipment against nerve gas as a possibility, and understand that this is an unnecessary, reckless, wrong war in general, which has been thrown into almost humorous relief by the fact that all the reasons that have been given for the war apply much more intensely to North Korea, which Rumsfeld points out we're going to use diplomatic means for. Apparently, when we came up with the the following we learned now from whistleblowers, essentially. Without the whistleblowers that are actually occurring right now, the plans that have been leaked, the background, our knowledge of the disputes within the administration, which we never had during the Vietnam War. We did not get that. And we are getting more now. So that's creditable and it's useful. Without those whistleblowers, I think right now, we would not have the progress that is shown by the fact that rather than that there were 133 votes in the House against this war, rather than zero in the House in 1964, not including a single Democratic major person running for the presidency next year. Not one of them could bring themselves to face the charges in that of being insufficiently tough and militaristic and whatnot. So we had Biden, Daschle, Richard Gephardt, Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, John Edwards, Lieberman, every one of them raising their hands, and I think every one of them knowing better at this point. We as a country can do better than we're doing now, and although that is progress, as I say, it doesn't keep the Senate from covering itself with shame, especially the Democrats. But as I say, we'll let them know that we expect better of that. And I'm glad to see the sign that some people in the Pentagon, CIA, and elsewhere are actually telling the truth now, which I wish I had done later. In fact, when George Tenet, the director of CIA, no hero of mine up till this point, sends extraordinarily a letter to the intelligence committees, giving the lie, without using that word, but clearly giving the lie to almost every statement the president had made, that was not a good career move for George Tenet. It really was unprecedented. I have to ask myself, how could that possibly have happened? I'll give you a conjecture, which is in its way a hopeful one. And that is, the only reason I can think of his doing that, because he didn't get to where he is by contradicting presidents, is that he was faced with a revolt in his own CIA ranks. That they said, this is too much. We cannot have the president making these statements about links with Al-Qaeda and imminent threat from North Korea and all that, totally contradicting our own estimates, which we know is the case. We aren't going along with that. And he was faced with a near mutiny, as happened, by the way, during the Cambodian invasion with the State Department. So you might say, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt. Well, yes, those people are Americans. They are human. Humans can decide to make a choice in favor of truth-telling, and that can make a difference.
The head of the CIA was, in effect, deep throat on the record, I think. David, can I add something to that? Another example is the U.S. Army Rangers in Afghanistan. I don't know if you remember when the film came out showing the CIA torturing John Walker Lind and other people. That film was made by the Army, and they managed to kind of lose it where a reporter could find it.
The last question for Dan is, have you spoken with Robert McNamara since the end of the Vietnam War?
Well, I've actually tried to speak to him. I've approached him a number of times, and he said a number of times, by the way, when people asked him if he would discuss this stuff with me, which I really wish he would, actually. I've talked to him very tactfully, but he has refused to talk to me on any occasion. I broke what he regarded as absolute norms. I betrayed him. I betrayed the president. I betrayed the team. I did things that he said he would never do. His highest norms. I know those norms. I acted by them for a long time, and I don't take them lightly, and they are needed. But I had come, and if this is the last question, I noticed in the line of questions a number of people asking, well, what did change you? And let me pass on that thought, something that I'm afraid Robert McNamara didn't have the luck, maybe, that I had to read certain things, to meet certain people at a time when I think he could have done more than he did do. Two things. I knew the war was getting bigger under Nixon. I knew that from inside sources, but I knew it as an insider. A fellow insider, Mort Halperin, told me what was happening in the White House and the war was getting bigger. So I was burdened with this very special knowledge that's told in the story here. What to do about it? That was the question. And I read a number of books there. Barbara Deming, Revolution and Equilibrium. I read over and over again, actually. Gandhi and Literature, Joan Bondurant of the University of California here. But in particular, an essay by our American Henry David Thoreau, which is originally called Resistance to Civil Government, usually known as The Duty of Civil Disobedience. Civil disobedience, resistance to civil authority, a duty? How could that be? He wrote that in the immediate aftermath of having spent a day in jail, a night in jail, which would have been longer, but as he said, someone paid the fine against his will. To protest a war that turns out, I didn't know this until I read that, to have been clearly an aggressive war, the Mexican War for annexation, as U.S. Grant put it, who took part in it as a lieutenant. I was reading his memoirs the last year. He said, one of the most unjust wars ever waged by a larger country against a smaller one, in which we were imitating the traditions of the monarchies of Europe in their aggression. And Grant said, I regret that I lacked the moral courage as a lieutenant to resign from the army in that case. Well, that was Grant at the time, but right at the time, just after the war, Thoreau was, and I was reading this, he said, in certain circumstances, disobedience is a duty, as when, quote, a whole country, Mexico, is unjustly overrun and conquered by a foreign army, when the other country has not attacked. when ours is the invading army. Instead, he said, obedience to leaders in that case is itself a choice, the wrong choice. He said, in his state of Massachusetts, a soldier who refuses to serve in an unjust war, I didn't know there were any. I'm interested. I'm asking the historians here if they know anything about civil disobedience and or refusal in the Mexican War. But he says, such a person is applauded by many, but not imitated. Out of the, quote, thousands who are, his underlining, in opinion, opposed to slavery and to the war, who yet, in effect, do nothing to put an end to them. They hesitate, and they regret, and sometimes they petition. All those are important, by the way. They hesitate, but they do nothing in earnest and with effect. They will wait, well-disposed, for others to remedy the evil, that they may no longer have it to regret. At most, they give only a cheap vote. And then he went on in words that really burned in my mind in the summer of 69. Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. A minority is powerless while it conforms to the majority. It is not even a minority then, but it is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight. A month after I read that, I met people who were choosing to go to prison as a choice, young Americans, draft age, to send the strongest possible signal to people like me that this is an emergency situation, which I believe it is today. It was not a time for the usual, to be content with the usual things which are all necessary, and I've been doing for 2 years at that point. Lobbying, speaking privately, speaking truth to power in private, to no effect. The war was going on and getting bigger. The time had come not to question authority, but to answer authority, to tell truths that authority didn't want told to the public, to give power to the public. That's the way I saw it, reading Thoreau. And the people who went to prison put the question in my mind, what can I do to help end this war now that I'm ready to go to jail, as they are? They had set that example. Their courage was contagious to me, as it always is. And so their example led me to think of quite a few things, of which the Pentagon Papers was just one, and it seemed like the least important, but perhaps the most personally dangerous. But it was only history. If I'd had current documents, I would have put those out, as I'm urging people to do right now, and as some people are doing. But the key thing, I think, for all of us to remember as Americans, vote, yes, absolutely, the vote. But cast your whole vote. That's what Barbara Lee has been doing. It's what Barbara Boxer was doing in leading the fight in the Senate. It's what Senator Byrd, not generally a hero of mine, a man who filibustered in 64 against the Civil Rights Act and voted for the Tonkin Gulf Resolution along with Edward Kennedy then, and has regretted that for 38 years. There are many senators now who will regret their yes vote for the rest of their lives, just like Senator Byrd. But regret, shame, accountability, that's not the issue. We must demand, we must change our lives, I think, in this crisis, cast our whole vote for those in influencing those senators to use their whole power, the filibuster, hearings in the lame duck session that's about to come, hearings that would call the people that Biden shamefully refused to call, Scott Ritter, other experts, Nelson Mandela, some authority on the norms here when he says this is an aggressive war that must not happen. Even Barbara Lee, in a minority, could, as I pointed out to her, could call informal hearings. Kerry, who voted wrong on this, Edward Kennedy could hold formal hearings and call these people and educate the public to change the political environment in which these decisions are made. And it's up to us to demand that they do that, to change our lives, that they change their lives, so that we all cast our whole vote. Thank you.
I want to thank the Golden School and the World Affairs Council for co-sponsoring our program this evening. I want to thank our panelists, for their excellent comments, and I especially want to thank Daniel Ellsberg for his superb and courageous work. As I mentioned earlier, Daniel will be in the front lobby on the mezzanine level shortly to autograph copies of his book, Secrets. We hope everyone will be able to get a copy. Please visit our website at independent.org. We look forward to your joining with us at another Independent Institute event. Thank you and good night.